Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. While the Republican plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act is dead for now, far too many of us are still stuck with high premiums and inadequate care. At the same time, health insurance companies continue to generate astronomical revenue. Why isn't this part of the debate? In the Center for Public Integrity, former Cigna executive turned whistleblower Wendell Potter writes that those who have benefited the most from the Affordable Care Act are the top executives and shareholders of health insurance companies. Axios reports that Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Humana, and United Health Group, the five for-profit insurers that are the biggest, made $4.5 billion in net earnings in the first 3 months of this year. Last year, Aetna CEO made $41 million. Stephen Helmsley, United Health CEO, made $31 million. And David Cordani, CEO of Cigna, made $21 million. So how did we get here? Why have health insurance companies become so central to our healthcare system? And why isn't this part of the ACA debate? In her award-winning book, Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers, today's guest, Nancy Toms, examines how and why patients are treated like consumers or shoppers. She challenges the notion that in order to get adequate coverage, we have to learn how to shop for the right plan, which then turns healthcare into a commodity. Nancy Toms is professor in the Department of History at Stony Brook University. She was honored with Columbia University's 2017 Bancroft Prize in American History and Diplomacy for her book, Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Hi, Nancy. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and thank you for writing this book. When I was reading your book and reading about it, it was kind of shocking to realize that over the last few weeks with this very heated debate about the ACA, we rarely heard about health insurance companies and their massive profits.
Absolutely. I mean, that you're one of the first people to ask me that question, and I'm so happy. I think it's really symptomatic of how we are like goldfish in the bowl. We swim in a water where it's just assumed that we're supposed to be a profit center for not just insurance companies, but a lot of other corporate players. And instead, the argument gets framed as a choice between government and private enterprise, when in fact, government and private enterprise are so entangled that it's virtually impossible to pull them apart.
You spent 15 years writing your book, and before we dive in, I just want to get your overall thoughts about what happened last week. Because the headlines are that, you know, John McCain came in and saved the day because he voted no, when in fact the two women, Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins, were the Republicans who were no's the whole time. But I think that the main story here, the big story, is that 45 Senate Republicans voted to take health care away from 22 million people, drastically cut Medicaid, defund Planned Parenthood for a year, and give a $1 trillion tax cut to the ultra wealthy. And then we had 49 Senate Republicans vote to take health care away from 16 million people. I mean, what are your thoughts on that? This is almost the majority of the Senate Republicans voted for these bills.
I spend a lot of time, especially lately, trying to understand what is the antipathy on the part of the Republican leadership today to the concept of universal health insurance. Just to step back, I would say the entire last 5 years I was writing that book, I was in a cold sweat that Obamacare was going to first not pass and then get overturned because I would have to rewrite the last chapter. I mean, it's so selfish. I kind of hate myself for saying that. Now I got the book out, and I feel like I'm watching a cross between a circus and a train wreck. Mm. It is so bizarre what is going on. The good news is I think it is so bizarre that I finally begin to sense some shifting and some very long-term public opinions that could, in the long run, be good for us. You know, you've probably heard of the Trump boomerang effect, that he's so out in the realm of the offensive that people who used to question the idea of healthcare being a privilege are now starting to say something is really wrong when Jimmy Kimmel can say what he did about his son's open heart surgery and have a conservative Republican slam him on the grounds of what you're trying to do is to get me to pay for your sick child. Well, yeah, that's what civilized nations essentially do. The contrast between the cliff that we're headed over in the United States and what is happening in Europe, in Western Europe, in this, it just couldn't be clearer. This is we're being sold a kind of return to the good old days that I did not find ever existed, when private insurance, in fact, dominated in the United States. And the reason government had to get involved is because private insurance wasn't doing a good enough job.
Yeah, we were just talking this morning about how, hey, this is a great opportunity for the media to take a look at how healthcare is provided in other countries where people do not go bankrupt, where children with disabilities don't have to raise money to travel across the country, which is what happened in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, actually. Children with disabilities got on a bus. And Rod Stewart heard that they were short $30,000, and he cut them a check because he was shocked that this was happening. But it's a good time for the media to say, hey, let's take a look at how this is done in places like Japan or Canada or the UK, for example.
Yeah, amen to that. I just came back from a month in the Netherlands, and I was invited there in part because people who do healthcare policy are worried about Americanization. They see what we do as something to be guarded against. And the biggest lesson I learned was the strength in Europe of a concept of social solidarity that is sadly lacking in the United States. You can be a conservative in Europe and still believe that healthcare is a universal right and that government should play a role in making it accessible and high quality and affordable. It's only American conservatives who have adopted this position that there is something inherently evil in any kind of collective scheme that enables people to band together in groups to finance healthcare. It's bizarre, and yet it really our chickens are coming home to roost. In that, you can make a moral argument, and I'd be glad to do that. I believe in it strongly, but just in terms of global competition, our attitude toward making health insurance a privilege that only the right people and right in a almost a literal sense have is putting us behind in terms of making staying ahead in terms of global competition. In the Netherlands, people are very entrepreneurial. They don't sit around worrying about how they're going to pay for their medical care. It's covered.
How do you explain what has happened on the right? A couple of weeks ago, there was an event with the Koch Brothers Network, and the AP had a story that quoted members telling Republicans that if they don't repeal the ACA, the piggy bank would be closed.
I think a lot about this because there is a myth that Republicans always oppose expanding health insurance. In fact, that's not true. If you go, you look at Eisenhower, you look at Nixon, Ronald Reagan, who's the guy who said government is always the problem and never the solution, his administration oversaw one of the biggest expansions of Medicare, the catastrophic care piece of it. Why was that? Because, in fact, those Republicans realize that government supporting health care is very beneficial to the economy and especially the entrepreneurial corporate side. I mean, there is no separation of government here and business there. Government enables businesses to do their business. So you asked the question about why don't we look more at health insurance companies. I mean, the lobbyists for health insurance companies, for pharmaceutical companies, for medical device makers, they far outspend in terms of influencing both Republicans and Democrats to vote the way they do on healthcare legislation. What I can't get my head around, and maybe you all will be able to help me, is why now, when you have so many of the big players, including insurance companies, saying, don't do this, Koch brothers. Mm. This is not a good idea. You have the medical profession saying, don't do this. So it's not just Roman Catholic nuns writing in and saying, you know, this is ungodly. It's members of the entrepreneurial class saying you're going to destabilize everything if you persist in this craziness. I've got to think a piece of it is just 8 years of Obama, and because it says Obamacare, it's got to die. So even though there are clear benefits not only to citizens but also to companies, if you shore up the ACA, you don't kill it, you mend it, don't end it, they just seem to be blind to this at the moment, like lemmings going over a cliff.
Today we're speaking with Nancy Toms. She's the author of the award-winning book, Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Nancy is professor in the Department of History at Stony Brook University. And today we are talking about healthcare. And why is it that we don't spend more time talking about the health insurance industry? They have made record profits. In the first 3 months of this year, Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Humana, and United Health Group made $4.5 billion in net earnings. And CEO pay, Aetna CEO Mark Bertoloni, $41 million last year. Stephen Hemsley, United Health, $31 million. Why isn't this part of the conversation? And why do we not spend more time talking about how health insurance became such an integral part of the healthcare system in the U.S.? If you have a story to share about the premiums that you pay, the kind of coverage that you have or you don't have, we'd love to hear from you. While so many people are relieved that the Republicans failed to repeal the Affordable Care Act, so many of us still pay very high premiums, out-of-pocket costs. We get inadequate care. If you have any questions or comments, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Tell us a little bit about the history of the health insurance market. And when did they start to make such massive profits?
So Americans have long had a love affair with insurance. I think it's part of our individualistic ethos. So the, you know, going back to the colonial period, we invented the idea of fire insurance because we had so many wooden buildings. Earliest form of insurance was to take out fire protection. Benjamin Franklin, 1752, helps to found insurance company against fire in Philadelphia. These were all individual health insurance. So the idea was if you were an upstanding, responsible person, you would insure your property, your home, your business, against unanticipated hazards. So it starts with property insurance, and then somebody gets the idea of, well, your body is your property. How about life insurance? So in the late 19th century, everybody starts, you know, or at least wealthier people, let's have life insurance. So if I die, you know, my family will have money, et cetera, et cetera. What's really interesting is you get this huge expansion of commercial insurance. Nobody wants to touch insurance for healthcare with a 10-foot pole. It's viewed as too risky, and on an individual basis, it's hard to predict sufficiently, and especially back then, they didn't have the same kind of prognostic measures, you know, to sort of look at somebody and say, you smoke, you know, four cartons a day, you're going to drop dead. So nobody was interested in any kind of health insurance until the Great Depression. And where our insurance system started was it was not for profit. It was Blue Cross Blue Shield, which many of us still have, you know, a modern descendant of it. Mm-hmm. It was teachers during the Great Depression who wanted to have a scheme to build up a nest egg to cover them if they had to go to a hospital. And this was a time period when hospitals were starting to offer treatments that could really help people in a way that they couldn't, say, in 1850. But it was the idea you pay in, and eventually your employer will start to pay in, and then it, when and if you do have to have an operation, the hospital costs will be covered. Originally it was the hospital, and then it expanded to the doctors who were treating you in the hospital. So by the 1950s, this idea of it was not for profit, Blue Cross, Blue Shield, but here's the kicker. It was run by doctors, for doctors, and hospitals. Hmm. So there was no cost control. It's, yeah, you know, one reason that I hated, I didn't hate, but one reason understanding the history of insurance is so difficult is it makes your head hurt. It's very complicated. But here's the bottom line. When people started having insurance to cover hospital care, their physicians were incentivized to start treating them more in hospitals. And when they got in the hospital, more doctors, like, you know, you get a separate bill for this doctor, that doctor, whatever, it became a moneymaker. And it fueled the rise of specialties, especially in surgery in the early days. And guess what? The premium costs started to go up. Now, if you were an executive, if you were a professional working for the state, or after World War II, if you were in a high-end union like the steel workers or the Detroit unions, you got this coverage as part of your hiring package. It shifted from being strictly individual to you got it as part of your employment. And employers start to help contributing to this. Their theory is, if my employee is not worrying about their health, if they take good care of themselves, you know, that's better for me. Like IBM offers these really good health insurance packages because they want the best executive talent, right? What you have by 1960 then is a private insurance. It's still mostly not for profit, although the Blues do so well that the commercial people start coming in and saying, hey, you know, maybe we should get in on this action, but it's not all that easy for them. The problem is, what happens when you retire? You lose it. What happens if you're a huge number of workers in this country who aren't unionized because, frankly, unions back in the day were about white men getting, I mean, they were, not that there weren't any women in unions, but or people of color, but the early union movement in this country is pretty, you know, upscale. It's like privileging workers in the big industries. If you're a maid, a domestic worker, if you're a farm worker, you don't get coverage. So the poorer you are, you also don't have access. Now, this private system drives up the prices for everybody. It's right. An inflation machine.
Well, and also we have now an independent contractor economy. So many people are independent contractors who do not have health insurance. And the premiums, there's no cap on the premiums, and they just keep going up. And to that point, Nancy, we have a caller who wants to talk about this issue. So let's hear from Frank in San Francisco. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the show.
One defense of our current system is that most people get their medical insurance through their employer. I have two questions. What percent of people have to get their policy on the open market? And number two, what would happen to these health insurance policies, private health insurance policies in a state that adopted single payer?
Thank you. Nancy, do you know what percentage of people have to buy their own insurance because their employers don't provide it?
I don't know the exact amount, but I can tell you, Frank, that it's going up because, and this goes back to the point that the days of IBM and sort of big automobile companies taking care of their employees is gone. The amount of loyalty of a company to the employee, you know, that's one reason jobs go other places, is because companies want to ditch that kind of obligation to their employees. Frank, I can tell you that it is the minority as opposed to the majority. Most Americans still get their insurance coverage when they're under 65 through their employer. But the numbers of people who are left out and then forced to go and bargain as individuals is quite high and has been statistically the source for most of the lack of coverage. I think we were up to what, as high as 17% or 18% before the ACA. That number has come down. Not everybody in that pool was a self-employed business person or an employee of a business under 50. That was kind of the marker, but the majority of them were. So you've put your finger, Frank, on the problem of getting people covered. It was the ones who weren't working for a company big enough to provide these more cost-effective group plans.
Nancy, I also have a question about small businesses, because we often hear that small businesses cannot afford to pay to cover their employees under the ACA. Wendell Potter, who used to work at Cigna as a high-level executive who's now a whistleblower, he wrote a piece for the Center for Public Integrity and writes that several million previously uninsured Americans now have coverage because of the ACA, but it could be argued that the people who've benefited the most are the top executives and shareholders of the health insurance companies. Among those who have not yet benefited, at least so far, are owners of small businesses who would like to keep offering coverage to their employers, or their, I'm sorry, their employees, but they can no longer afford it. He writes, they cannot afford it because insurers keep jacking their rates up so high every year that more and more of them are dropping employee health benefits altogether. Now, the way that it's usually framed is that the ACA makes these costs so high. It's not usually framed, you know, saying that it's the insurance companies that keep raising the premiums, and so therefore these small businesses can't afford it.
Again, this goes back to the wonky side of it. There was never any expectation with the ACA that it was going to work without government subsidies. That's why the taxation piece is so important, of raising taxes on Americans to pay for the cost of subsidizing care for those groups who aren't good profit centers. I mean, it really is about the insurance industry wants to cherry pick, and they want to get contracts that will keep their, you know, their profit margin very high, and if you're not an attractive prospect, they're not interested in you. They have to be made to be interested in you. They've got to have government subsidies of some kind. They've got to get a deal cut for them. Again, you're absolutely right. We don't give a lot of attention to that, in part because there's this knee-jerk assumption that only by having a private market incentive are you going to get good quality care. The ACA has the problems it does because largely Republicans insisted there couldn't be a public option. We're told this is about choice. Why can Americans not choose the public option? But that Obama and his people had to take off the table because the lobbyists essentially said, you're not doing that. The Republicans said, no way. If it doesn't make a private company some kind of profit, it's not the American way. That's the message. And that's where I think we need as a nation to think about how that blind allegiance to the church of the free market is killing us, literally.
Nancy, do you think the Democrats did enough to push for the public option? Because I remember the health insurance industry had many, many seats at the table, whereas single-payer doctors did not. And during the hearing process, they actually got arrested for standing up and saying that they wanted a seat at the table.
So, you know, this is kind of a painful it's painful to look at the history of Democrats and health insurance. To go back to the earlier point, when government starts to get involved with Medicare and Medicaid, the deal that was struck then was the way Johnson and his folks got that passed. Republican and AMA opposition was by saying there wouldn't be any cost control.
Mm.
And so there's this devil of a deal if you're a Democrat to expand not just health insurance, but, you know, many aspects of the welfare provision. You have got to bend over backwards to placate various groups who feel that their entitled right to a profit margin is going to be threatened by government enrollment. You know, it's really easy to sort of sit back and say, oh, you know, they should have done more with Obamacare. I have to say, as a historian, the fight for single payer has just been so brutal for so long that I want to see change, and we should get to talking about how can we move forward, because I asked my 23-year-old daughter this morning what she wanted to know about, and that was what she said is, tell me how the hell we get out of this for my generation. But rethinking exactly the issues that we're talking about, I think, are key to that.
Well, Frank, thank you for calling in, and we will get to your single-payer question after the break because we have a number of emails about single-payer. Today we're speaking with Nancy Tom. She's professor in the Department of History at Stony Brook University, and she is the author of Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Nancy spent 15 years looking at the history of the health insurance industry and looked at how we became shoppers. Why is it that we're always told that we have to shop around for the best package? And at a time when millions of us have very high premiums and we have high out-of-pocket costs, Axios reports that Aetna, Anthem, Cigna, Humana, and United Health Group made $4.5 billion in net earnings in the first 3 months of this year. So why isn't this part of the debate about healthcare? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. You can call us on the telephone. You can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may go to our website, yourcallradio.org, if you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone. Call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's toll-free, 866-798-8255. You can also tweet us at Your Call Radio.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with ProPublica's investigative reporter Jesse Eisinger about his new book, The Chicken Bleep Club. It traces the history of white-collar criminals and looks at why former President Obama's DOJ failed to hold top bankers accountable for the 2008 financial crisis. And then on Wednesday, we're going to take a look at Big Pharma and its role in the opioid crisis, somewhat related to what we're talking about today. Thursday, what does Standing Rock reveal about political surveillance? And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are speaking with Nancy Toms, professor in the Department of History at Stony Brook University. And she's out with a book, Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. She spent 15 years looking at the history of the health insurance industry and wanted to ask a very basic but very important question. How did we all become shoppers? Why is it that we're always told to just shop around for a cheaper plan? We've got full lines. We'll have one open in a couple minutes. You can email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org, tweet at Your Call Radio, or give us a call in just a few minutes at 866-798-8255. Nancy, James wanted to know, what happens, for example, in a state like California if we get around to passing Medicare for All or single payer? What happens to the health insurance companies? Nancy? Did we lose Nancy? Okay, we're gonna try to find Nancy. I'm not hearing the air. Maybe there's a Nancy, are you with us? All right, you know, why don't we take a couple of calls in the meantime? Maybe Nancy dropped off. Can we take calls? Okay, and then we'll get Nancy back on. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Well, I just wanted to follow up on something I believe Nancy said, which is that the healthcare industry pays more in lobbying than the Koch brothers. So I guess my question is why the Koch brothers have such a huge influence and not the healthcare industry. And I see the healthcare industry starting to get organized now. I hear them now on NPR and other places and in full page ad in the New York Times. But I didn't realize they were already lobbying for the Affordable Care Act, because it benefits them, as we said. And I also think that, you know, I think that single payers, government-paid single payers, like, obviously the best. But in Germany, they do have private insurance companies involved in universal health care. So I guess, again, I've asked this before, why it seems to serve the big capitalists, the insurance companies who are making huge profits, as she's pointed out. Why do the Koch brothers have so much power, given that, is it just because of their political organizing, because they've been so effective in politically organizing the right?
Yeah.
So that's a huge mystery to me, and I'm sorry Nancy's not there to answer this, because I believe that's what she said. Am I wrong?
No, that's what she said. I think we have her back. Nancy, are you back?
I got dropped.
Oh, okay.
Mysteriously. Yes, well,
we're
back.
We're glad you're back. So Lisa wanted to follow up on your comment about the Koch brothers and the health insurance lobbyists.
Yes.
And she wanted to ask you, why do you think the Koch brothers have so much influence over all of this? I mean, what I've been reading and what we see is that the Koch brothers tell the Republicans that if you don't pass the legislation they want, they will primary you from the right, and they will fund a candidate on the right to primary you. I mean, look what happened to John Boehner.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So what are your
yeah.
thoughts on that?
I don't understand, and in fact, this is a little research project I have for myself, is to try to figure out why this has become such a holy grail to the extremist branch of the Republican Party, all the more so because, as I was saying before, you go back and look at Republicans in the past, and, I mean, Reagan talked the line, but when it came down to do business, he dropped that line. So I don't have a good answer. I'm as puzzled. Is it perhaps some of the social issues that they're, you know, this is really about, or in part about reproductive rights? Is it the hatred of Planned Parenthood? I don't know. I'm kind of baffled myself.
What about that $1 trillion tax cut? Because the Senate bill included a $1 trillion tax cut that would have gone to the top 1% of earners. And Warren Buffett said if this bill passed, he would have received $680,000.
Well, I think that, okay, you've reminded me that essentially all it was a wealth care bill. The proposed, this is all about relieving the tax burden on one percenters. And this idea that you need to kill government spending, it's fine, you can spend money on defense or, you know, things that the Koch brothers think is important, but social services for the average American are just not part of the picture. I mean, some academics wonder if this is just the eugenics movement coming back. That really, this is about, I only want to pay for myself and my family, but that's also code for saying, I only want to pay for white, rich Republicans, and don't ask me to cover the health care of a person of color, or God forbid, someone who doesn't, come from a Caucasian background. It has some very scary overtones of the old eugenics movement and the idea that, if you're poor, somehow you're biologically defective or you're immoral. I hear echoes of that in some of the most extreme Republican rhetoric. And what baffles me is that they don't seem to feel in the least that that's unchristian or they just throw it out there like they think we're all going to agree with them. It's scary stuff. But then Donald Trump is president, so why should any of this surprise us?
Well, Lisa, thank you for calling, and you might want to listen to the show we did with Nancy McLean, who wrote about all of this, the history of the Koch brothers and the libertarian ideology that they embrace. And that book is called Democracy in Chains, and you can, well, actually, it's not fair to call it completely libertarian, but far-right conservatives. We were both just saying that we don't really like the labels because a lot of libertarians do not agree with a lot of these policies. But you can find that at yourcallradio.org. And thank you for calling, Lisa. Let's go next to William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. The guest, I think, is more balanced, with all due respect, more balanced than you, because she mentioned that the Democrats are affected as well by the money and the influence of the insurance industry. You seem to pin it all on the Republicans being, anyway, that's my perspective. But I would remind you that when the amendment was offered in the midst of all of the debate in the House of Representatives, when the amendment was offered, forgive me, in the Senate, to allow Americans or U.S. people to buy medications in Canada. Cory Booker, who's regarded as the bright light of the Democrat Party and possibly the next presidential nominee, and Patty Murray from the state of Washington, both voted against the ability of Americans to buy medications in Canada. And just by coincidence, perhaps, both of those states have very large headquarters for pharmaceutical companies.
Indeed,
right.
They do.
So when those of us who are in the Democrats are saying, oh, my God, here we go again, they're going to sell us out, I have to tell you that when things like that happen, it really makes us feel that way.
Well, William, this was a Bernie Sanders amendment, and 13 Democrats voted against it. Ourfuture.org shows that Cory Booker has received $267,000 from the pharmaceutical industry, Patty Murray, $254,000. The list goes on with these other Democrats.
Yep.
What is a progressive Democrat to do?
Well, depending on what day you talk to me, I'm so depressed. But today I'm going to be a little more optimistic. I think the conversation has opened up to the point where pushing within the Democratic Party to say, look, we cannot go down that, that way lost us the last election, and it's going to lose us more if we don't come up with plans that really speak to what people want and are not so dependent on lobbyist directives. So maybe that is a little bit hopeful. One thing that's occurred to me, William, and I don't know if you've thought about this as well, is the the kind of odd thing here about states' rights, that states' rights always used to be the property of really conservative racist people. But, you know, what's to stop Massachusetts or California? I don't know about New York. Ugh. I'd wish. But, you know, a state could go single payer and show that it could work. And that might really change the conversation. So long as you have this lock of private lobbyist interest, it prevents experimentation at the national level, but it could work at the state level. What do you think about that?
Well, we've been trying it in California for many years. As Sheila writes, ask Nancy, please, about about Democrats, going back to Democrats, including Governor Jerry Brown and their appalling actions against single payer. Yep. She says, I've been in this fight since the 90s, and it's a sorry tale.
Yes. Now you've made me depressed again because I'm almost 65. How many times, forget the caller's name, was it Lisa?
Yes.
Lisa, have we been told that single payer is just around the corner? I remember that in the 70s. I remember it, you know, with Ted Kennedy. It's like, it's so hard to get there. And, you know, your callers are putting their finger on the essential problem, and that is both parties are deeply embedded in this private-public partnership, and they're not looking out for our interests first. They only look at, and that I mean patients, the public. We are low people on the totem pole.
Mm. Well, thank you for calling in, William. Thanks for your email, Sheila. Let's go next to Alicia in Berkeley. Hi, Alicia. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to compliment Nancy on sort of defending Obama's efforts. I feel like since universal health care has been on the table since Teddy Roosevelt, it's practically a miracle. Seriously, it has if you look it up. It's a miracle that Obama was able to do anything, and he certainly has opened the door to moving in that direction, no matter how long it takes. But my question is, I am over 65 and I'm on Medicare, and I pay over $300 a month for the supplemental Medicare D and Medicare B payments that I have to make every month, which for a person on only Social Security, I don't know how they do it. It's really a lot of money.
Yeah.
But so my question is, if we were able to ever get to universal health care, would that affect Medicare for seniors and disabled people in terms of the amount of money they have to pay just to round out their insurance?
Only if the cost control piece, there's more attention to that, because one of the side effects of the American way of doing things is there is this concept that you need to pay for what you're getting or you will overuse it. This is, again, is not an idea you see so much in Europe, that if you make care affordable that people will overuse it, but it's been this kind of thing in the United States about insurance from the get-go. There's all this focus on you. You need to pay extra so you don't misuse. But the part where somebody is looking at how a physician or a hospital, how they are over-treating because it is part of their income flow, that is another area that just, like the insurance piece, tends to get shunted to the side. There's more attention to how you and me are potentially misusing all this wonderful, you know, the government's being so kind to you. I mean, in fact, we pay into the system. But it's like we have to be deterred from, misuse of care because we're, I don't know what they think, we're just... Yeah, you think it's fun to go to the doctor, but somehow that is one of the, again, puzzling and to me creepy aspects of policy discussions. And they don't go quite back as far as Teddy Roosevelt, but that idea that if you make it too easy for people to get care, they're going to misuse it, that argument is popping up in the 20s and 30s, and it really hampers us. Why do we need to do this?
It's also so interesting to learn about the pharmaceutical industry and TV ads. And you write in your book that until the 1980s, pharmaceutical companies could not advertise a doctor's services. The AMA made it, basically said it was unethical, but the DOJ sued and said that people have a right to this information, and now we are bombarded with pharma ads. It's the United States and New Zealand are the only countries in the world that allow this, right?
That's right, and that's another reason that I'm kind of popular on the European circuit, because none of them want to see direct-to-consumer advertising, so they like to hear what all the problems that it's brought in the United States. But again, that was a government decision and something that essentially pharmaceutical companies had not done it because the medical profession said no. It's not against the law. It was never against the law. It was opposition from doctors. But as, I mean, one thing we haven't talked about here is how physicians as well as patients have lost a lot of control of this system, and that they are really feeling, a lot of them, the pain as well. Part of this was getting doctors out of the way so companies could sell more stuff. That was like the power of the medical profession had to be brought under control. The spectacle of all the major medical associations saying, you know, coming down on the side of Obamacare, I mean, just historically, that was not the case. If you go back to, say, Medicare and Medicaid, they were opposed to it.
Can we talk just quickly, we don't have much time, but about Big Pharma. Again, when you look at the CEO pay in 2015, the CEO of Regeneron, Leonard Schleifer, $47 million. Jeffrey Leiden, the CEO of Vertex, made $28 million. Johnson & Johnson, Alex Gorsi, $21 million. And Kaiser Health News has a piece about how prescription drug costs are on the rise. And then the New York Times had a story recently about how big pharmaceutical companies are spending more on share buybacks and dividends than they are on research and development. And this comes from researchers at the Academic Industry Research Network.
Absolutely. And one of the long-term factors here that we need to pay more attention to is the shift from late industrial to post-industrial, where profit centers are in the 21st century is in service economies, and healthcare is big business, even bigger than it was in the 1950s. So when you start messing around with, you're looking at industries that essentially their profit margins here are based on being able to raise the price of prescription drugs, and doing things like forbidding the federal government for bargaining for cheaper prices. Again, that's a case where government is setting rules that enable the prices to go up and then expecting us as consumers to just go along with that without asking questions. But obviously, a lot of people are asking those questions.
Right. And Nancy, we have about 3 minutes left. Would you talk about a system overseas, for example, that you look to as one of the best solutions to this issue? Because we can't leave people, as you said, you got depressed a couple times on the show, and so many people are outraged over this issue, and rightly so. But there's so many other models out there that the United States, a country like the United States, could embrace. What would you like to see?
Oh, I would definitely like to see a more solidaristic approach that you could see. I'll take the Netherlands as an example. They pay a lot for their health care. The quality is top drawer. So it's very forward-looking. It's innovative. Government is involved in the provision of health care, but not in ways that incentivize pure profit. They have a kind of instinctive revulsion against the idea of making healthcare strictly profit-driven And I think a lot of Europeans, I just went to see Dunkirk last night, the going through World War II, having your countries devastated, and then having to rebuild, reinforced a sense of solidarity in Western European countries. And it's not an accident that the kind of broadening to universal health care, it comes after and is part of World War II. Mm-hmm. In the UK, the beverage plan that came out of the World War II experience. Britons were all in this together. The Dutch, occupied by the Nazis, we have to rebuild. We've never had that experience in this country. I think we've had a kind of casual attitude. We always have enough people. We can work them hard, and if they die, we'll go get more. That's just not working for us anymore. So solidarity and looking for ways to control costs and spread at the same time you accept that wealthy people do need to pay more in order to take care of the poor, period.
And this is a life and death issue for so many people, including so many children, people with disabilities.
Yeah.
Based on the research you did in your book, looking at the history of the health insurance industry, have there been movements over time that have raised their voices and said this system is not working?
Oh, absolutely.
What
and
worked?
You can, well, it's not necessarily what worked, but you can look at the welfare rights movement. I mean, a lot of the sort of pressure to expose the weaknesses of how Medicare and Medicaid were working, you know, came from people of color as part of the civil rights movement, who started pointing out the two-tiered care that, you know, that they were getting through Medicaid was so inferior to that being given for, you know, more affluent white elderly people. You know, so the voices have been there. The unions have been a long-standing critic of the profit motive, you know, even though sometimes they've kind of perpetuated the sense of a little bit of elitism. They have been a major force in calling out the inequities of the system we've got. So there's been a long history of criticizing the individualistic and the profit motivation. It's kind of getting that into the political party in a ideology that's been so hard.
Nancy Toms is professor in the Department of History at Stony Brook University and author of Remaking the American Patient, How Madison Avenue and Modern Medicine Turned Patients into Consumers. Nancy, thank you for the 15 years of research you did for this book. Thanks for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Great. My pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with ProPublica's investigative journalist Jesse Eisinger about his new book, The Chicken Bleep Club. He traces the history of white-collar crime and looks at why Obama's DOJ failed to hold top bankers accountable for the 2008 financial crisis. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Sanaa Saleem for producing today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us. This is Your Call.